ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Welcome to ID, the Future. I'm Andrew McDermott. Today, we're sharing the second half of a recent interview with Dr. Jonathan Witt, conducted by the Denison Forum podcast. Dr. Witt is executive editor at Discovery Institute Press and a senior fellow and senior project manager with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. In this interview, Dr. Witt and host Dr. Mark Turman discuss the central question and main points of Witt's 2006 book, A Meaningful World, How the Arts and Sciences Reveal the Genius of Nature, co-written with Benjamin Weicker. The book tackles the question of whether the world is meaningful or meaningless, purposeful or pointless. Witt argues that the cosmos is charged with both meaning and purpose, from the works of Shakespeare to Euclid's geometry, from everyday substances like water and carbon to the intricacy of biological organisms. Today, you'll hear the second half of the conversation. Dr. Witt shares the four characteristics of genius that he and co-author Weicker identified in iconic works of great literature and art, and he explains that the same characteristics are evident in the natural world too. He provides several examples of such genius in art, as well as in biology, mathematics, and cosmology. Let's get back to the conversation now. Here again is Dr. Mark Turman, hosting Dr. Jonathan Witt.
Let's go down a couple of those roads, because just to kind of give people a framework of what this book and this conversation is about, it might be expected by people to say how science reveals the genius of nature, but the combination of art and science as the revelation of genius, of this higher level of learning that points to the ultimate level of knowledge and understanding that we would find and place in God. And let me just kind of set a little bit of a framework for this part of our conversation. Is this, it just kind of startled me when I went from the title into the first part of the book and the whole discussion about how Hamlet, as this exquisite piece of literature, actually more, I think the book quotes what you say in there is, Hamlet has been more studied than any other piece of literature except for the Bible.
That's right. Yeah, it's extraordinary how much.
It is extraordinary for me just to hear that. But just to go back in and to say, okay, as an expression of something that we find in the world and in the human endeavor, to find something of this quality, of this magnitude, and of this, as you said, depth and exquisite nature, how does that point us and reveal these principles of genius that point ultimately back to God?
Yeah, that's so. When we use Shakespeare, you know, we could have gone to lots of different places as examples, but you know, we had to get it all in one book, and so we mainly focused on a couple of plays by Shakespeare, and then just kind of briefly, you know, pointed to some other works of genius that also illustrated these points. But Hamlet's where we start, and we show it illustrating these four characteristics that we boil down of genius. There's works of genius have a depth to them. You don't just read it once or go look at an amazing genius painting and just, oh yeah, I get it, I'm done. There's layers and layers of meaning and beauty there that if you keep studying it, there's a harmony to it. Harmony involves the artful relationship among a variety of parts, a diversity brought into happy association, if you will. The easiest example is musical harmony. You know, when you get four different parts and they're all blending together, it's a beautiful thing. When they don't blend together, it's, you know, a scary thing. But then in Shakespeare, you know, what does a play by Shakespeare have to do with harmony? Well, he brings these very disparate elements into harmony. There's comic elements in Hamlet. There's, and of course, it's a tragedy. So as you expect, there's tragic elements. There's elevated language. There's very earthy language, sometimes even body. But these elements are not just, oh, I'm getting tired of the dark parts. Let's have some fun. Oh, let's go over here and have a little body. Oh, let's have some elevated language. Those different aspects, they interpenetrate. They strengthen each other. It's, you know, kind of a 2 + 2 = 5 kind of thing. So there's this rich harmony there. Then the elegance. There's an elegance in the play, and I won't go into depth there, but you can see elegance in, you know, certain types of poems where the rhyme scheme just fits neatly together. In nature, we see elegance, and I've already kind of alluded to this with Kepler's 3 laws of motion. Everybody's familiar, even if, you know, not 1 in 100 people understand it, with Einstein's special theory of relativity, E equals mc squared. I mean, isn't it extraordinary that there's this far-reaching, probing insight into physics that can be so compactly expressed. So elegance, you know, it's the emphasis there on bringing of a unity out of something complicated. So we see that in Shakespeare. We also see clarity. And clarity isn't like newspaper, like a good newspaper. It's very clear and easy to read. That's not what we mean by clarity. Clarity comes from the Latin claris. It means bright, shining, illustrious, evident. Let me give an example that probably most people on this radio show are familiar with, the 23rd Psalm by David. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures, you know, et cetera, et cetera. This beautiful psalm. Well, why did he use all these metaphors? And, you know, it's going to be hard for like a 10-year-old kid to get it, because he, you know, doesn't know about shepherding, and metaphors can throw him off. Why didn't David say, the Lord takes good care of me. He won't, he'll give me everything I need. Water and other stuff. He'll always be there for me, even in tough times. That's clear. Well, it's clear, but there's no radiance to it. There's no, the power, the shining, illustrious quality is gone from it. And so works of genius have that clarity, that radiance about them. So then we took those four: depth, clarity, harmony, elegance, and we said, okay, now let's turn to nature and find those. And of course, I've already mentioned how the founders of science, they expected depth, they expected elegance, and they went and found them. Another great example is this this Russian chemist from the 19th century, Mendeleev. They were starting to build the periodic table of elements that, you know, probably gave a lot of us nightmares when we were forced to yes. forced to learn it, and others dreams, and, you know, fell in love with it. The few of us yeah. that really got into chemistry,
I can still see it. I can still see it on the wall of my seventh yeah. grade chemistry yeah. class. Yeah.
For some of us, no. But once you start to get it, even if you don't get all the depths of it, it's like, wow. There's an order. There's a pattern to it. You know, those columns aren't just kind of random. Oh, let's put them all up here, and we got to put it on a poster, and so we'll kind of make it rectangular. You notice how it's not quite everything's even. Well, those columns, mm-hmm. the elements in those columns tend to share characteristics. I mean, they're each distinct. They share characteristics. And what Mendeleev did is somebody before him, John Newlands, said, "I wonder if there's a pattern, an octave pattern, like every eighth element repeats and has something in common. Maybe, mm-hmm. but then it didn't quite fit. And never mind. And I give up on that." But Mendeleev, who was a theist, believed in a wise creator, he said, no, I think there's something here. I think there is a pattern. I think this law of octaves may be real. And so he stuck to his guns, and he said, you know what? If this law of octaves is real, there should be an element here that's missing that we haven't found yet. And over here, there should be one that's missing that should fit in this column. Which is, how's that doing science? It's kind of weird. It's not usually like, oh, it's totally you gather evidence and you experiment and you have observations and then you come to conclusions. Well, he was doing some of that, but he also had this idea that God, the creator of the periodic table of elements, was an orderly God, and there had to be some hidden order. And he stuck to his guns, and because of that, they started turning up the missing elements. Gallium in 1875 was the first thing. It fit. It was like a puzzle. It fit right in where he predicted it would be. So that's just one of many examples of how scientists, seeing nature as a work of genius, went out, had that framework, and it helped them do science better. So we go through the book and look at different areas and look at that, whether it's depth, harmony, and that's, since we've written it, we could do it afterwards now, particularly in biology, where we said we thought we'd given you a good taste of the depths of biology and biochemistry. We were just getting warmed up because of the last 15 years. They're discovering things like in DNA, you'll get stretches of DNA and you can move it over to a different, slightly different reading frame, and it'll create another, it'll have some other function. And you can read it backwards and forwards, and it'll have two different functions. So imagine a written human code that, oh, I've read it front ways, now I'm going to read this section backwards, and oh, it has a really important meaning too. Or software that did that sort of thing. So it's just off the charts, ingenious stuff that they're discovering.
Yeah. So let me get you to define a couple of terms, and then I got another question for you. But just so I know that I'm on the same page with you, give me the working definition of how you're using the word genius.
Yeah, genius would be artistic genius. Well, genius would just be, is loosely termed as somebody that's really brilliant. But it really has a little bit more formal definition in both when you think of artistic genius and scientific genius, of doing something deeply original as well as extremely difficult and that requires a lot of intelligence. So you might have somebody that's brilliant, but if they're not creating something new, they're not having a breakthrough, in the stricter sense of the word genius, you wouldn't, you know, call them a genius. So Einstein was a genius because he had this extraordinary breakthrough. There might be somebody with a higher IQ that could score a little higher on an IQ test than Einstein, but that IQ test wouldn't make him a genius in this narrower sense of the word. It would be these people that have this ability to make these great creative leaps. So, you know, Shakespeare is a genius because of the creative, just distinct way that he did his plays. But then, of course, there was also a greatness to the artistry. It wasn't just that they were different, distinct, fresh.
Okay, so if I follow you correctly, then these qualities, particularly these four qualities of genius, as we find them reflected in any part of our created world, become reflections of God as the ultimate genius.
Yeah, the ultimate genius, yes. And they also help us grapple with some things, because when you approach a work of genius, if you do it with the right mindset, like when I first came to Shakespeare in high school, I didn't get all that. The language is 400 years old. Right. It's like being thrown on a black diamond ski slope and, hey, is this fun? You know, and you've never skied before. No, it's not fun. It's scary and weird and I don't know what's going on. For a lot of us, that's our experience of Shakespeare in high school. We dip in 2 or 3 weeks, assume that kids can pick up, you know, 400-year-old English, and if not, they're stupid, which, no, it's almost a foreign language at this point. But if you stick with it and you have, okay, surely all these people down to the ages that have found this amazing depths and riches in Shakespeare, if I stick with it, and, you know, you have some aptitudes, some people, you know, are good at different things, then you're going to uncover some amazing stuff there, and it's going to start clicking, and you're going to go, oh, I see why he did this, or you know, why he didn't just use the simpler way of saying this. Or when you come to, you know, poetry in the Bible, oh, I see why all this poetic language that made me scratch my head at first, I see now what the writer was up to. So you bring that patience, that humility to the work, and it can make all the difference. It's the same with when we come to nature. Why does the earth have to have earthquakes? You know, if God were a loving, good God, he wouldn't have any earthquakes. Well, maybe, but maybe God has purposes and reasons that we don't know about. And scientists, by the way, have discovered some purposes. We can circle back to that in a little bit if you want. Purposes for our active geology that leads to earthquakes. And then there's theological answers to that too. You know, why doesn't God make our lives completely free of suffering and challenges? You know, would that really be good for us fallen creatures? I mean, there's a reason he had Adam and Eve leave the Garden of Eden after they sinned. It wasn't just because he was grumpy at them. He knew that having everything, you know, easy street for people that were fallen and sinful was not what was best for them. I digress a little bit, but when you think, hey, this is a genius, I need to approach it humbly, rather than I'm smarter and better and wiser, and what's this idiot doing? bring that humility to it, you're going to learn more. You're going to discover things. It's just, it's going to be a more joyful, interesting journey.
Right. And as a process of revelation, I just, you know, it's hard to have this conversation not be from my chair thinking about Romans 1 and what Romans 1 tells us about the reality of God being revealed on so many, all levels of life. And that the reality of it is that we're bumping into expressions and reflections of God's genius all the time.
Even without science.
And we may not appreciate them. And as you are kind of walking through these qualities, it makes me think along these lines of, you know, when you read a great novel or you see a great work of film, you know, I think of a couple of Stephen King films that come to mind, actually, when I think about depth. And I'm like, oh, wow, you know, if I go back and think about that movie again, or I think about that novel again, or I go back and watch that movie again, I'm like, oh, I didn't see that before. And that idea of depth and layer is in there as it pertains to a great story. If you talk about harmony, and as like you said, we probably almost resonate with that one quickly because of, well, we know when a piece of music is not done in harmony, it's painful to our ears. And we're like, oh, that's just not good music. I just don't want to be around that. That's not good music. It doesn't sound right, because we have this internal sense of what harmony and the intersection of harmony might look like. Clarity, your example about the 23rd Psalm is really helpful. I got to tell you, Dr. Witt, the one I'm struggling with a little bit is elegance, is wrapping my understanding around this quality of elegance. As an expression of beauty, as an expression of genius. Can you unpack that one just a little bit more for me? Is it simply unity, or is it more than unity?
Yeah, that was when we formulated these, I was struggling a little bit. How do we distinguish harmony and elegance? Because they're so closely related. I finally, you know, told Ben, I think they're really two, you're coming at the same thing from two different angles, and it's kind of the emphasis is more. So elegance is a type of harmony, but the emphasis is on a very compact unity among a diversity. So, you know, I gave the example of, you know, you've got all these planets coming around the sun, right? And they've got different orbits, and some are out far and near, and they're not all exactly on the same plane, though they're very close to the same plane, interestingly. But then Kepler comes up with these laws, these three very elegant laws that describe all that diversity. And so that would be an example of elegance. Mm-hmm. We see in nature, are you familiar with the Fibonacci number?
Yes, a little bit.
There's this Fibonacci number. The number is, I'm trying to remember how it's like, you get it by adding the last two numbers. 1 + 2 = 3. 2 + 3 = 5. 3 + 5 = 8. Anyway, then there's this number that comes out of that, a ratio. And we see that the golden rectangle uses the Fibonacci number. We see spirals all through nature that use this Fibonacci number, the shell of a nautilus, the spiral of galaxies, the number of seeds in sunflowers. They'll have a Fibonacci number. It might be, you know, one, or it might be a bigger sunflower, but it's always going to have this Fibonacci number, or almost always. Just hundreds of examples. So that would be an example of elegance in nature, where, wow, all of a sudden there's this Fibonacci number cropping up all over nature. Eugene Wigner, he was a scientist and thinker, and he talked about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics for the natural sciences. And that's just like the fine-tuning problem. It's only unreasonable if there's not a God in heaven, if there's not a creator. But if the creator God is a master mathematician, and when he was creating this elegant universe, and there's a documentary, by the way, called The Elegant Universe. I don't think the people that made it were believers, but they see the elegance in nature. So you find that mathematical elegance cropping up all over the place.
So talk about that. I'm glad you brought up math, because I'm sitting here imagining, you know, my young granddaughter learning learning her numbers and eventually learning her mathematical or multiplication tables and ultimately long division. I'm thinking about that kid that's encountering algebra or calculus for the first time. Have had some exposure to the English professor John Lennox, who is a world-renowned mathematician. It seems like so many things come back to the beauty and genius that is revealed in mathematics, and so many things, even theologically, that come back to a connection to and even an anchoring within mathematics. And if you, you know, to the person, the average person that may be listening to this, if you've ever had that joy of balancing and reconciling your checkbook and doing that regularly and having some problems with it and then figuring it out and the joy that comes through that,
yeah.
Or if you're an accountant and you've ever drafted a budget for a company and then that budget actually worked itself out in real time and in real business, and then you were able to reconcile that, then you're touching on some of the genius of mathematics, not to mention the connection between mathematics and something like music. But can you touch upon how these qualities of genius particularly express themselves mathematically, not only what you were just talking about, but perhaps in other ways as well?
Well, let me back up a minute. I thought of an example of elegance in biology. Biology is often so sophisticated and complex. We don't elegance isn't usually the term. It's like dizzying sophistication or something like that. But when Watson and Crick were trying to discover the structure of the DNA molecule, they implicitly, even though I don't think either of those guys at the time were believers, but they inherited this cultural tradition. Heritage of theistic science that said, look for elegance, look for harmony, look for depth. And they would reject, as they kept doing do these toy models of what they thought the DNA molecule shaped like, and kept, you know, comparing it with what little bit of microscopic evidence they were able to glean at the time. And they would reject possibilities that were too kludgy, too inelegant. And when they finally hit upon that, they got a view of an X-ray crystallography image by a female scientist in another lab. That's a different story where they misbehaved a little bit there. But then, of course, that other lab couldn't figure it out from that. At least at that moment, they couldn't. Maybe if they'd had longer. But Watson and Crick took it back and they looked at it, and there was this kind of cross thing. And they came up with, they said, what about a double helix? Like take a picture, a ladder that's twisted. So that gives you this double helical structure. It says, what if that was it? And that would also kind of help explain how DNA copies. So the two parts could come apart and then they could attach. And it would, of course, be very sophisticated to copy, but at least we'd have the first inkling of how that might be happening. But it was the elegance of it that was a big part of what caught their attention. They said, let's double down and explore that option. But you ask about mathematics and music. Is that what you said?
Yeah. Well, and just how mathematics is so much an expression of genius across multiple areas.
So yeah, one of my weakest areas in terms of expertise is music, but as probably anybody knows, even if you're not a musician, you know that music theory is just rife with mathematics. You get the different octaves by, you know, you can take a string that's, you know, a wire and you loop it in two and then half it, and you get roughly an octave, and that C note, and then a C note later, they sound good together. There's something common about them, and then that's just the tip of the iceberg about how mathematical music theory is. Most people who are really good at music, they just pick it up. They may not even know math, but there's mathematics, you know, richly under that. And of course, chemistry is rife with mathematics. Physics is almost all mathematics at this point. Even, you know, before Einstein, you know, Isaac Newton's his great landmark work was just, you know, rich in mathematical equations, cosmology, mathematics, understanding of thermodynamics, the different laws of thermodynamics, which is now helping us understand things like blood flow and how different things in the body work. One book I'd recommend if you're really, you're not as into kind of arts and sciences, but you're like, I like biology and the human. There's a book called Your Designed Body that's written by a physician and a systems engineer. And they take a systems engineering perspective to the body. And there's so much harmony there. It's unbelievable. And in places, elegance, but the harmony of these interacting systems. And some of that, some of the breakthroughs in understanding how fine-tuned the human body goes back to, you know, it requires a mathematical analysis, how certain things are being kept in these very narrow ranges, some of the chemicals in our body and why they need to be kept in those narrow ranges. So yeah, mathematics is indispensable to so many fields of science.
Yeah, it just makes me think, if you've ever gotten the lab report from your doctor at an annual physical, you know, how did they come up with these ranges that, you know, all these things in your body needed to be within this number and that number? And
right.
And when they're not, then they start going looking for causes and problems.
This book I mentioned, of course, I want you to go out and buy my book. But if you buy a second book, after you bought A Meaningful World by Jonathan Witt and Ben Weicker, take a look if you're interested in human biology at this book, Your Designed Body. They go through, and we take a lot of these for granted. Oh yeah, my phosphate level, or you know, whatever, my iron level's in the right zone. You know, of course it is. No, your body has to be doing all these ingenious things to keep all of those at just the right level. Even a cell, you think, oh, a cell's got X amount of stuff in it, and it's got these ratios. Well, on the outside of the cell, the ratios are completely different. So how is it maintaining these very different ratios that it needs to? You know, homeostasis is the word. If it loses homeostasis, it becomes like its environment. When you become like your environment, you become dead. You know, when you die, your body, you know, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, all that hardworking, ingenious stuff that's maintaining homeostasis between the individual cells, all the different organs of the body, that quits, and it starts to, you know, return to room temperature and in a whole lot of other ways, like the environment. It's that genius of our designed bodies that keeps it going as long as it does.
Just fascinating. I just feel like I could continue to just ask questions all day long. But as we get ready to wrap up and just kind of think, I want to go back to what your colleague Stephen Meyer was talking about and what you referenced a little while ago about earthquakes and other things like earthquakes within our experience. Dr. Meyer alluded in our conversation to how we might understand the presence of miracles as they're described in the Bible, as they're described in the life and work of Jesus. And he said, you know, perhaps a better way for us to understand those kinds of things in answer to Dawkins and others would be that if we accept the idea of God and then we accept his ability to intervene in his creation, that those expressions of miracle are not really the interruption of physical laws and the way things normally operate. They're actually a glimpse of the restoration of them. That when, just for instance, Jesus healed a person, he was not interrupting natural processes as much as he was picturing the resetting of them the way they should ultimately always be, and we would go on to say will be, in the kingdom of God.
That's beautiful.
Talk about that from the standpoint of, okay, how is that possibly a reflection and an expression or an answer to the presence of things, you know, this common idea of, well, if there is a God and if he is a genius and if he is good, then how can he let things like a pandemic, how can he let things like cancer, how can he let things like a hurricane or an earthquake happen? How might we think about those things in a cohesive, reasonable way?
Yeah, I think you come at it at two levels. One is, scientifically, some of the things that have been pointed to is that's pointless. It has no, like earthquakes, that's pointless. Well, it turns out our active geology is crucial to Earth being livable and habitable over thousands and millions of years. The way our the plate tectonics, continental shelves recirculate things, And there's a great book called The Wonder of Water, where Michael Denton, an Australian geneticist, gets into all the ways that active geology, including water and all the ways water is done, help us. So that's one example. You know, you talk about Richard Dawkins complained, well, a wise God wouldn't have made the human eye the way it is. It's backwardly wired, and we've got a little tiny little blind spot in our eye. Most of us aren't even aware of the blind spot. It's so tiny and easy to ignore. But as it turns out, there's good engineering reasons for the quote unquote backward wiring of the eye that Dawkins just ignored because he was so quick to jump on and critique the wiring of the eye. It improves oxygen flow. So it ultimately improves visual acuity. And so, you know, engineers get this very quickly that they know that any kind of complex system, there's going to be trade-offs. And you can't have, you know, you can't have the sports car, the best sports car in the world that's also got the most hauling capacity. You know, you're going to need a pickup for that. So there's trade-offs. So he ignores all that, and he found something he didn't quite understand, and he jumped on it and criticized it. Whereas if he'd said, maybe there's a reason for that. Now, so that's the scientific, you know, be humble. Maybe there's a reason for it. Then you get things like, well, what about diseases where little kids, you know, die or they go blind? And, you know, that just seems terrible. And it is. But then you have to realize you're also asking a theological question when you say, why would a good God allow suffering and pain and death? And some people, unfairly, they ask a theological question, but then they won't allow a theological answer. They won't allow you to say, okay, you're asking about God and his nature. Well, God has revealed himself to us through his word, through his son Jesus, and he's given us resources to understand why a good God might allow suffering. It has to do with, and it's not a simple answer, but it has to do with he made free creatures. He made humans free, and they fell into sin. There's indications he made angels free, and some of them fell. It seems to be the source of Satan and all the mischief he's sowed in the world. He knows our hearts. I talked about earlier about Adam and Eve being kicked out of the garden. It wasn't just because God was huffy because they took some of his fruit off his tree. He knew that to restore them, they had to enter into suffering and be challenged and be humbled so that he could bless them in a greater way. But those are theological answers. Of course, there's, you know, you could have many shows, you know, probing and plumbing those. My main point here is people that ask good theological questions, they're ones we should all wrestle with and concern ourselves with, should though be willing to hear theological answers, should be willing to go to that mode of knowledge to get answers. And it's that scientism, that false philosophy that asks a theological question says, oh, well, I don't want to hear a theological answer.
No, they want to skip categories at times.
Yeah. I'm thinking science is going to solve everything. And if you can't solve, well, that proves that there's no God. No, that's not good logic.
Right. Dr. Witt, thank you. It's such a fascinating conversation and such an important, insightful, and yes, challenging book, A Meaningful World, How the Arts and Science Reveal the Genius of Nature. Would encourage our audience to pick that up and other work that you've done. If they want to track and follow more of what you are doing these days, where can they find you besides the bookstore?
Yeah, I would go to discovery.org. That's Discovery Institute. And you'll see a section for intelligent design. You can go to the fellows there. You'll find my page under the senior fellows there. And then, of course, there's a lot of other great material, a lot of other great science. I talked about rubbing shoulders with some brilliant scientists. It's just been so exciting. Michael Bee, Jonathan Wells, Steve Meyer, others. So it's just a great resource, discovery.org/ID.
All right. We'll put that in the show notes as well. And just want to thank you, but also thank our audience for being a part of the conversation today. If this has been helpful to you, please rate, review us on your podcast platform and share this with your friends, your family. Really a lot for us to think about, a lot for us to learn, and a lot for us to celebrate about the beautiful design and genius of God as it is revealed around us and in us and all around us. And again, Dr. Witt, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mark.
That was the second half of a conversation between Dr. Jonathan Witt and host Dr. Mark Turman on the Denison Forum podcast, discussing how both the arts and sciences reveal genius in us and in nature. If you haven't heard part one of this stimulating conversation, you'll find it in a previous episode. I want to thank the Denison Forum once again for permission to rebroadcast this conversation. You can learn more about that podcast at denisonforum.org. That's denisonforum.org. And if you'd like to dive deeper, get a copy of Dr. Witt's book, A Meaningful World, co-authored with Benjamin Weicker. For ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.